Blog Talk Radio.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello everyone, I am Nick Peters and welcome to the Deeper Waters podcast. I am very excited today to have a guest that many of you in your projects will know about. That will be Greg Coker of Stand to Reason Ministries. And so, Greg, are you here?
I am, sir. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing good. It's been a couple of years or so, I think, since I've seen you, maybe about a year and a half or so. Good to hear you again.
That's right. It's good to talk to you, and I'm so glad you got your own show. Good for you, Nick.
Good. Thank you very much. Before we start discussing your book, Greg, a lot of people might not be familiar with you right now, so tell us a little bit about who you are, how you came to be where you are today, something about your ministry and why my audience should consider you an authority in what you're talking about.
Well, that's a lot to talk about here, Nick. I'm glad we have an hour. Well, the organization I represent is called Stand to Reason. We're approaching our 20th anniversary, May 1st, so we've been around for almost two decades. The goal of Stand to Reason is to train Christians to think more carefully about their convictions and to be able to defend their convictions with people who don't agree with them, but to do it in an incisive way, but in a gracious way as well. We're trying to build Christian ambassadors, as you know, Nick, and this means Christians that have skills in the area of knowledge, wisdom, and character. That is, they understand the foundational issues of Christianity, and they can tactically maneuver. This is what we call wisdom, kind of an ability to take that knowledge and use it well in a diplomatic way. And then the character that commends the message rather than undermines it. We want our engagements with people who disagree with us to look more like diplomacy than D-Day, is the way I like to put it. A little more than 20 years ago, I was challenged to, I was a staff pastor at a local church in Southern California, and I did some teaching for them and some writing for them, and I was challenged to focus more on the things that I cared about most, and that was defending the faith and showing that Christianity is worth thinking about, helping Christians to have a deeper understanding of the intellectual heritage of Christianity, and also trying to deal with the shrill tone that was often characteristic of Christians engaging non-Christians on these kinds of issues. And that was the impetus that started Stand to Reason now nearly 20 years ago. And Melinda Penner and I started it, and now we've got 14 staffers. We have four speakers. We have a worldwide reach through our own podcast. I've been doing talk radio since 1990, even before Stand to Reason started. And that, of course, has been parlayed into a national broadcast now at the American Family Radio Network and an international presence with the World Wide Web and podcasts and the like. And so using the radio show and using our website, the Stand to Reason's website is easy to find. It's STR for Stand to Reason, STR.org. And people can download over 1,000 pages of content and information, articles I've written, resources, the podcast, the blog, the video blogs, all kinds of stuff that are there. And we are part of a larger movement that, Nick, you're aware of, and you're part of yourself, to train the rank and file Christian to think more carefully and to be able to stand, in a sense, toe-to-toe in a gracious way with a culture that is increasingly hostile to Christian things. And so there's kind of a thumbnail sketch of what we're about. and why we're here. You asked about credentials. I have a bachelor's degree in biblical studies. I have a master's degree in Christian apologetics, and I have a master's degree in philosophy that I took under J.P. Moreland. And so all of those things, plus the 23 years experience in talk radio and writing books and the like, interacting with people on a regular basis, speaking at more than 65 college and university campuses around the country and some overseas, has kind of put me in a unique position, I think, to be able to instruct followers of Christ on a productive way of engagement. And that's what the Tactics book is about. The subtitle of the Tactics book is A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. And that's what we try to do at Stand to Reason. Build ambassadors who have a game plan that will allow them to get into productive conversations with others.
Okay, now, for my listening audience, my wife's on the chat, by the way, and she's entering in all the information about your website and such. But for the listeners who might want to hear your radio show, could you tell us what time it comes on?
Well, it comes on, I broadcast live right now on Sundays from 2 until 5 West Coast time. So there's 3 hours of live broadcasting, Nick. And it is picked up the last 2 hours. That would be the three to five segment West Coast time is picked up around the country in the American Family Radio Network. So people, if there's an outlet there in their city with the AFR network, then they can listen live that way. But I'll tell you, most people, Nick, now listen on podcast, and the reason is because it's so easy. You can have it downloaded. You can listen at any time you want. You can pass it on to other people. It's free. You can get that at iTunes or str.org. So I suggest that if people want to listen on a regular basis, the best way to do it is by subscribing to the podcast.
And this show is also on podcast for anyone who's interested. Now, let's start talking about the Tactics book. Technically, Tactics really isn't an apologetics book, in the sense that if you want to know, for instance, if God exists or if Jesus rose from the dead or about the moral argument, Tactics isn't the book you'd go to, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good insight, Nick. There are certainly lots of contentful things you can glean from the book, because in all the issue of Tactics, I give lots of illustrations that turn out to be kind of little nuggets of information pertaining to apologetics. But the purpose of the book is not to do apologetics per se. The purpose of the book is to give the follower of Christ, the Christian, some skills, a game plan that will allow them to take the driver's seat in a conversation. And I mean that in a good way, not to manipulate, but to manage, not to overwhelm people, but to have a productive conversation. And so this is really about positioning yourselves more than anything else. It's about how do you get a bridge between the content and the conversation. You and I have both been to lots of conferences where you get all the information, you know, and that's really great. And the smart guys come out, like to SES there in your neck of the woods, and to the annual conference every year, and or other places around the country, and they listen to people like William Lane Craig and Lee Strobel and a whole bunch of other smart people that have made a real good contribution. They get a lot of information. Then the question is, though, how do you get from the content to the conversation? How do you get from the scholarship to the relationship? And that's the gap that the Tactics material fills, I think, Nick, it provides that practical bridge, that missing bridge. So it helps people who not only who have studied, as you have and others at these conferences and on your own, take that information and get it into play, but it's especially good for people who maybe they don't know a lot, but they still want to begin to be used by the Lord in extending the kingdom. And this gives you a place to start, a way of engaging and building conversational skills with people.
Okay. Now, if anyone wants to call in, by the way, and ask Greg Coker a question, he's here for the first hour. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. Now, when you were talking about this, Greg, one thing I was saying is that As you know, I'm an avid reader. I mean, I've got books all around me. I've got a Kindle. When I go out in public, I've got a book and my Kindle with me. And my wife's looking at me like, why do you need both of those? Just in case. Just in case. And you never know what could happen. Like, hey, if we're stalled in traffic somewhere, I want to have something with me.
Yes.
Now, on the other hand, my wife, who is managing the chat, isn't an apologist. But I know every now and then she could wind up getting caught in a conversation. I think your book is written also for someone like that, someone who's just wanting to do something, and they're not one who's going to go read all these scholarly books, but they're just wanting to be able to engage in a conversation at times. Now, if you were talking to someone like that who wasn't a skilled apologist and such, and they were saying, I get caught in these conversations. People ask me these questions. I don't know what to do. What should I do? What would you say?
Well, this is a perfect lead-in to the game plan, because the promise I make in the book, and I think I deliver on it too, the promise I make in the book is that I will give the reader a game plan that will allow that person to converse with confidence in any situation. And this is key, and it sounds like a bold claim here, but I fulfill on it. Will allow that person to converse with confidence in any situation, no matter how little they know. And that would include the circumstance you just described, say, with your wife or someone like that. Or no matter how little you know, or how aggressive or articulate or educated the other person may be. So people think, oh, that's a tough situation. I don't know much. And the other guy who's on the other side, boy, they know so much more than I do. They're more articulate. They're more clever and all of this. And so how do I compete? How do I hold my own in that situation? And this is where the game plan comes in. Now, at Stand to Reason, we have lots of different tactics. We have tactics with names like suicide and taking the roof off and just the facts, ma'am, and road scholar and steamroller. And these all have different uses in conversation. They're maneuvers, if you will. But there is one tactic that is central to the enterprise. And in fact, the game plan itself, the game plan proper, is embedded in this first tactic, which I call it the queen mother of all tactics, Nick. It's the simplest tactic imaginable to stop a challenger in his tracks, to turn the tables, to get him thinking, and to put you in the driver's seat. And this tactic is called Columbo. After the infamous Lieutenant Columbo of TV fame. Now, this TV show, the Columbo TV show, is about 3 decades old, but everywhere I go, even overseas, in recent last few years, I've been in Egypt and in Italy and in Hungary and the UK, and everybody knows Lieutenant Columbo because he was such an iconic figure. He would show up at the crime scene wearing a old trench coat, looked like he slept in it, had a stub of a cigar, had a pad of paper for notes, but he couldn't use it because he always forgot his pen or pencil. He had to bum a pencil off of somebody. And he'd be walking around the crime scene, rubbing his head, muttering to himself. And this guy didn't look like he could think his way out of a wet paper bag. You know, he was stupid, but he's stupid like a fox because he had a plan. And at some point, you know, he'd stop and put his hand to his brow and like he's deep in painful thought. And he'd say something like, I don't know, there's something about this thing that bothers me, you know. And then he'd add, do you mind if I ask you a question? And he'd ask a question and he'd get some information back. And he'd say something patronizing like, oh, you're very intelligent. One more thing. You know, and then he'd one more ting him to death with all these questions. And this was his method. He kept asking these innocent questions or innocent-seeming questions. And this is how he solved the crime. See, the key to the Columbo tactic, and this is the game plan. This is the game plan that will allow you to maneuver with confidence in any situation, no matter how little you know or how aggressive or articulate or educated the other person can be. The key is asking questions. Now, just think of it for a moment, Nick. If you are in a group of people that you don't even know anybody, okay, and let's just say you, and this isn't the case with you, but just the listener says they got a high school education or something, and they're with all of these super smart non-Christian people, okay, and they want to be able to make a difference. Now, they probably had been thinking before that the way that you evangelize is you start out a conversation and you start preaching in a certain sense to the other person, maybe preaching in a conversational way, but you're preaching, you're giving your point of view and you're trying to persuade. Now, that's a little daunting because you're thinking, I don't know much, and these guys are really smart, so how do I even get going here? Well, if instead of thinking about preaching, because you're thinking about evangelism, and evangelism has the end game in view, winning someone to Christ, what if we changed our perspective? What if we said, we're not going to preach. We're not going to be evangelists so much as ambassadors. You know, Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were speaking through us. We beg of you on behalf of Christ, be reconciled to God. So Paul understood that he stood between two parties, the sovereign he represented and those who the sovereign was trying to reach. So his goal was to be an ambassador, a representative. And if you think of yourself as an ambassador instead of an evangelist, then it seems to me it's easier not to think about, oh, I'm trying to force a harvest when maybe there is no harvest at that particular set of circumstances. Maybe I'll just go out and represent my sovereign in the best way I can in the circumstance I'm in. And that may not mean getting to the gospel. That may not mean winning someone to Christ, and it may not even mean getting to the gospel. And this, by the way, is a controversial part of my approach. I admit it up front. There are a lot of good people who don't like this view, but I'm standing behind it because I have seen the way it's energized other Christians, Nick, to kind of get into play. And what I tell people is I never have it as a goal to win anybody to Christ when I get into a conversation. That's not my goal. I don't even have it as a goal to get to the gospel. And the reason I don't, Nick, there's a couple of reasons, and one is that, you know, the simple gospel is not simple anymore. There's a lot of pre-evangelism, as Francis Schaeffer put it, maybe a lot of pre-evangelism that has to be done to kind of clear the way for people giving the gospel a fair hearing. That's true nowadays. But the other thing is, if I told your listeners that, here, I'm going to give you a technique, and the goal is to try to harvest the fruit in every situation, get the gospel out, try to challenge people to receive Christ, your listeners would, you know, nod and maybe take notes and say praise the Lord or whatever, but they wouldn't do it. And the reason they wouldn't do it is for most of your listeners, that's just too frightening. And I'm sympathetic to that. It is frightening. And so since if we set the bar up too high, then we won't even get into play. So I'm saying let's just lower the bar. Let's make it easier on ourselves. And instead of trying to harvest the fruit, win people to Christ, or even instead of trying to get to the gospel, how about if we just made it as a goal to get people thinking? Just get them thinking. Now, the way I put this is I tell the audience, I'm not here to convert you tonight. I want to put a stone in your shoe. I want to annoy you in a good way, kind of. I want to get you thinking, because I think that Jesus is worth thinking about. I think that what Jesus said and the way he saw reality is worth thinking about. And if I say something this evening, for example, in a lecture that I might give in a secular environment or a talk, or if I, in my own thinking, as I'm conversing with somebody sitting next to me on the airplane or in an airport or a waitress that's serving me at the table, if my goal is, what can I do that will just plant a seed, if you will, that will just get that person thinking? I'm not swinging for the fences. I'm not even trying to get on base. I'm just trying to get into the batter's box. And if you, I think, lower the expectations and you just do your best to try to give a person something to think about, and if you have a game plan that will allow you to do that, well, a whole bunch more people are going to get into play here, and you never know once you get into the batter's box what God is going to do. So that's my general approach there. I lower the bar. I lower my own expectation. Look, I have the training that I mentioned earlier. I have two master's degrees. I've written books. I've been on radio for 23 years. But I still do not think I got this so wired I can walk into any situation and I can make things happen. That's just not the case. God is the one who makes things happen, not men. And so even with all my background and stuff, I'm going to try to be tactically smart. Now, here's a verse that people might want to chew on that relates directly to what we're talking about, this tactical approach. And that verse is in Colossians chapter 4, verse 5 and 6. And Paul in Colossians 4, verse 5 and 6 says this. He says, conduct yourselves with wisdom towards outsiders. Okay? Be smart. Be careful. These guys are outside the faith. We want to draw them in. That's a persuasive enterprise. So let's be smart. Conduct yourselves with wisdom. And then he says, making the most of the opportunity. Now, opportunities present themselves, but they are very different from each other. Sometimes you're talking to a New Ager. Other times you're talking to a materialist. Other times you're talking to somebody who was a Christian and got burned really badly, and now they're out. And there's baggage there. And so every opportunity is different. In fact, that's what Paul says next. He says, season your words with salt, as it were, so that you know how to respond to each person. So Paul's advice there in Colossians 4 is to be shrewd as we pick our way through a conversation with individual people. And this is where the Columbo tactic just absolutely shines, Nick, because if you have some questions in your hip pocket or some model questions, if you have the game plan, you can, instead of preaching one way or another, preaching, if you're at this party like I suggested earlier, you don't have the big education, everybody else is smarter. What if you went around and just started asking questions? You drew people out. You know, you ask questions, you draw people out. That's polite. People like you already because you're showing an interest in them, and then you are listening to what they say. And it may not even be that you're starting on a spiritual topic, but as a good ambassador, you're being alert, ready for a circumstance where you might be able to make a contribution. These don't always work out, Nick. Sometimes conversations die a natural death. 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, I was flying to Montgomery, Alabama. And I sit next to me in the seat was reading a book on transcendental meditation or something like that, some Eastern religion thing. And I thought, okay, well, here's an opportunity. So I asked him if he liked the book. That's just a friendly gesture. And he said, yeah, he did. Now, there's lots of ways I could have gone in at that point. I could have said, well, what do you like about it? And then he might start talking about it. I could have asked, do they quote Jesus in that book? Now, all these books on Eastern religion always quote Jesus. But they mistakenly think Jesus was a Hindu. And Jesus was a Torah observant Jew. You know, he had nothing to do with the polytheism of Hinduism. You know, so, but notice how I can start asking questions that is meant to guide the conversation. Now, as it turned out, in this particular conversation, I asked a couple questions. We chatted for a few moments, and it went absolutely nowhere. It died a natural death. So I didn't push the conversation. I just let it go. Other times, it's just the opposite. I start asking questions. I get to know the person a little bit. Maybe things will steer towards spiritual topics. And a lot of times when they ask me what I do for a living, I tell them I'm a radio talk show host. I'm a public speaker and writer. And then they want to know what I talk about, what I write about. And there we go. And I try to put it in an interesting way. You know, I train Christians to think more carefully about their convictions and train them to have productive conversations with people. That's what we're about. Well, in this particular case, the guy started talking to me and telling me about his own life. And it turns out he wasn't a Christian. He told me that. But he used to be. And, in fact, he used to be a preacher's kid, but he's no longer a preacher's kid. Now, I was thinking, isn't he still his father's son? Well, yeah. It turns out he is his father's son, but his father is no longer a preacher. In fact, his father's not even a Christian anymore. So here's a former Christian who used to be a former preacher's kid whose father's not a preacher and not even a Christian anymore. Do you think that information is valuable for me to know before I can get further in a productive conversation? Sure. You know, if I would have jumped into the gospel right off the bat, that guy would have said, been there, done that, and it hurt, you know. This guy had a lot of baggage. But because I was asking questions, Nick, it was almost like a vision of his spiritual topography appeared in my mind's eye. The more you talk, the more you realize what's going on with this guy. And I realize as I'm looking at the map of his spiritual situation that there are minefields here. But because I asked questions and because I listened to the answers, very important, I was able to navigate around the minefields. And on that particular conversation, when we ended, I actually left with his email, which he gave me because he wanted me to send him some articles I'd written on the reliability of the New Testament documents. So I did that, and I didn't abuse it. He sent me an email back, said thanks, but I didn't chase him anymore because he'd been chased enough. But I did leave him with something substantive. But I want your listeners to see that in that conversation, when a hostile non-Christian gives the Bible thumper, me, is that the way he viewed me? You know, I'm the guy with the Bible. When he gives the Bible guy his email, well, that's trust. And I had won his trust in that conversation because of the tactical approach.
Well, it's certainly left a lot for us to think about, but for right now, we're going to take a quick break and come back. I've got several more questions, maybe even Columbo questions for Greg. The number to call in is 714-242-5180. I am Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast. We will be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grock Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at cyiworldwide.com.
And we are back to the Deeper Waters Podcast with Greg Kokrug. I'm here for a little over another half hour. Our number is 714-242-5180. In that last segment, when you talk about Columbo, and I have to confess, I haven't actually seen an episode of Columbo yet.
You haven't?
No.
Oh, you're culturally deprived, Nick.
Yeah, I'll make sure to correct me. I do happen to love mystery shows. I've seen every episode of Monk, and my wife and I love to watch Elementary on Thursday nights.
Sure. You know, Nick, a Monk is kind of like this age's Columbo. You know,
yeah.
We had Columbo 3 decades ago. We got Monk now. And he really fits kind of into that category. He has his own peculiarities, but very similar in style.
Yeah, my wife thinks she married Monk. And part of me was thinking, now I have justification to be annoying as well. Now, this Columbo thing, see, as you know, my wife and I are both Aspies. We're on the Asperger's spectrum, which next month, by the way, we're going to have a lot of guests on here talk about that for Autism Awareness Month. But I know for us, conversations in person can be extremely difficult.
Yes.
And so with this tactic, you're saying what we have to do is ask questions. And I'm thinking something that could be asked is, I'm not sure how I could figure out what question I'm supposed to ask. So if someone who's wanting to know, how can I determine what I'm supposed to ask?
Sure,
what would you
sure.
say?
Well, this goes to the specifics of the game plan, because I've used that phrase a bit, but I haven't really offered the game plan. The game plan entails asking questions. But I want your listeners to think of three different uses of questions, or the Columbo tactic. It has three uses. The first use is to gather information. The second use of questions is to reverse the burden of proof, and I'll explain what I mean by these things in a moment. So first, you're gathering information. Secondly, you're reversing the burden of proof. And the third thing you're going to do with questions, and this is this third one is a little more advanced, is you're going to use questions to make a point. Now, when you're gathering information, you're just asking open-ended questions to find out more about the person and about what they believe. So notice when you do that, there's no pressure on you.
Mm-hmm.
You're already kind of admitting you don't know anything, at least about this person or their ideas or anything like that. So there's no pressure on you when you're asking the question. You ask the question, and the ball goes into their court, and then they give the information, whatever it happens to be. The second use of Columbo is also one of those things where you're gathering a different kind of information, and I'll explain that in a moment, but in reversing the burden of proof. In the third use of Columbo, in order to make a point, now there you have to know what point you're trying to make. So in that case, you need to know something. But you don't need to know anything to use the first two uses of Columbo, and that is really the core of the game plan. And so when I said I'll give you a technique that allow you to maneuver with confidence in any situation, it's asking questions for those in those first two uses of Columbo. And I'll give you model questions for the first two uses of Columbo. Remember I mentioned the first one is to gather information.
Yeah.
And the model question, and this is very flexible, so you can say this a whole bunch of different ways. The model question is, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by that? Very, very simple. I talk in the book about a conversation I had with a witch in Wisconsin when I was on a holiday a number of years ago, and she was processing some film for my wife and I, and she was wearing a pentagram from her neck. Now, I didn't know she was a witch at first. She's just a gal behind the counter. But she has this huge five-pointed star around her neck. Now, that is classically, especially when it's a big piece of jewelry like that, is an occultic symbol. The points stand for earth, wind, fire, water, and spirit. And I asked her about it. I said, does that jewelry have any spiritual significance to you? And she said, yes. She talked about the five points and then said that she was a pagan. And so now I got some information. What was that first question? Well, the broad question is, what do you mean by that? And I adapted it in this situation by looking at her jewelry and essentially asking, what do you mean by that piece of jewelry there? And she explained it, and all of a sudden we're rolling. And the whole conversation is in the book on tactics. But the point there is I was able to get into a very relaxed conversation just because I showed an interest in a unique piece of jewelry that the woman was wearing, which I thought probably had religious significance, and so therefore there was an entree into those things. Lots of times you're not going to be talking about a spiritual circumstance. All you're doing is you're going to start drawing a person out and just be friendly to them. Mm-hmm. And this then sets up a congenial kind of atmosphere for conversation. Just keep in mind, you're in the research or question-asking mode, and so you're being polite by drawing them out. By the way, notice, Nick, that if you're asking questions like, what do you mean by that, well, you are now directing the conversation. Even though the other person is doing the talking, you're in the driver's seat. It's just like in this talk show, Nick. I'm as it turns out, I've been doing most of the talking, which is not surprising. But you have directed the show quite masterfully, would suggest, because I know what you're up to. You're trying to get me to tell my story in the book, and you're asking just the right questions so that this conversation goes in a certain direction, even though you're kicking back and I'm doing all the heavy lifting here. Because you are managing the conversation well with just the right questions. And this is something anybody can learn to do. It just takes a little practice, that's all. And they'll find it's a whole lot easier and more productive than preaching. If there's a spiritual topic that comes up or that's in play, people are talking about that, we look for opportunities to get clarification of other people's views. If somebody says, well, I don't think people should push their views on other people. Okay, what's my response? Well, I'm going to ask what they mean by that. That's the first question. I want them to talk more about it. Okay? If somebody says, well, everything's relative. All right. Well, I could, you know, try to refute their point. That's putting all the work on my side if I even knew how to address a challenge like that. But it's easier just to say, what do you mean by that? Now, those are two words. Everything's relative. Which words might be ambiguous in that statement? How about both of them? I don't know what they mean by relative. Maybe they don't even know what they mean. I don't know what they mean by everything. And by the way, if they mean everything by everything, then the statement itself, everything's relative, is part of everything, which means that the statement would be relative too. And there you got a little suicide tactic going on there. So my goal is just to continue to ask these questions to get clarification. And even when I'm doing my own show, Nick, and I have people calling in with questions, and they're challenging me, and it's really my job to try to give a response, I am still going to ask clarification questions over and over and over again, not to put the other person off, but to make sure I have enough information that will allow me to maneuver well in this conversation. And it is a conversation. When you're asking questions, you're talking, then they're talking. Then you're talking, then they're talking. So there's that give and take that makes it a more pleasant circumstance. So that's the first question. And you can ask this question, what do you mean by that, all day long until the cows come home, you know. And you're going to be gathering valuable information, and it won't seem abrupt if you're doing it in a friendly way. And there's no work for you. You just pay attention. Yeah. Now, here's the second use of Columbo. I mentioned it a moment ago, and the second use is reversing the burden of proof. Now, I know you know what burden of proof is, Nick. Let me just explain it to the listeners. The burden of proof is the responsibility to give reasons or evidence for a view. Now, we know in like American jurisprudence, you know, somebody gets charged with a crime. Well, who is it that bears the burden of proof there? Well, it isn't the guy who's charged. It's the one who makes the charge. If somebody, like the state says, John Doe here is... we think he's guilty of a crime, well, it's the state's job to come up with the evidence, all right? So it's innocent until proven guilty. Well, that's the basic principle of burden of proof. The person who makes the claim bears the burden. Mm-hmm. That is, whoever makes the controversial point, well, it's their job to come up with evidence. It's not our job to refute it. So, and this is a very important procedural point, especially for apologetics types like you and I, Nick, because we're the guys who are itching for a fight. We've done the reading. We've got the answers, and we want to go in there and answer all the questions, right? But so if somebody says, well, there is no God, we're going to drop down with the Kalam cosmological argument or the teleological or the moral argument or the ontological or blah, blah, blah. But there's an easier way to do it, because when we do that as kind of a first line of response to somebody's statement, there is no God, well, then we are giving them a free ride. We are not making any requirement on their side to defend their own view. Now, if you say there is no God, look at 99.9% of the people in the world think there's a God. Now, I suspect that many people could be wrong, but it seems to indicate that it's probably lots of good reasons to believe God exists. So that if somebody says there is no God, they're going against the grain, and it strikes me as reasonable to be able to give a rationale why you think most of the world is wrong and you're right on this issue. And so that's the move with the second Columbo question. You want to reverse the burden of proof, and you do that by just asking some form of the question. Now, how did you come to that conclusion? Mm-hmm. What are your reasons for that?
Yeah.
Why do you think that that is true? Mm-hmm. Notice that the Christian here is not taking any responsibility. Maybe when they said, I don't believe in God, you ask, what do you mean by that? And then they explain like what they mean, what kind of God they're rejecting, and maybe they don't believe in organized religion, but they believe in some spiritual force. Maybe they're materialists, and they don't believe in any of that stuff, but you don't know until you ask for the clarification. What if it turns out that they're just an enlightenment materialist type? Nope, there's no God, there's no immaterial things of any kind. Okay, great. Now, I think I understand you. Second question, how'd you come to that conclusion? What are your reasons for that? Notice here again that the Christian is gently going on the offensive. They're not being offensive. They are just asking the question that throws the ball in the court of the other person. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to tell your listeners a secret here, Nick, that might surprise them. The secret is, when you ask questions like, what do you mean by that? Or how did you come to that conclusion? And those are the first two uses of Columbo. You will be amazed at how many people will give you, well, what I call the Simon and Garfunkel response. Simon and Garfunkel, the 60s and 70s duo who wrote great music, they had a piece called The Sounds of Silence.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Yes, there it is. That's it. And so what you're going to get then when you talk to people about and you ask them these questions is you're going to get The Sounds of Silence. They're not going to respond. You ask mm-hmm. them what they mean by that. You ask them how they come to that conclusion. And sometimes they're just struck mute mm-hmm. because they don't know what they mean by that. They've never thought about it. They don't know how they came to that conclusion. They didn't come to a conclusion. They're just socialized to believe these kinds of things. This is true of Christians, too, Nick, as you know.
Oh, yes.
That Christians don't always know what they mean by that, and they don't always know why they believe things. And that's one reason you have your podcast, to help them out with
yep.
that. But the point is that don't be surprised if you ask a simple question, like I've suggested, and you get a kind of a quizzical look. They're not used to being asked those questions. And when the ball goes back in their court, then they don't always know how to respond. Mm-hmm. Try not to bail them out. Just let them try to answer the question themselves. So that's the long answer to your question. What are the questions you ask if you don't know what to do? There's your first two. What do you mean by that? How did you come to that conclusion?
Okay, well, we are going to take another break. When we come back, I think we've got some examples coming in because it looks like there's a couple of callers waiting in the wing wanting to talk
okay.
to you. So
sure.
we'll be back to answer your questions live after this break.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com. Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com. Home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
And we are back with the Deeper Waters Podcast. I'm Nick Peters, your host. We have Greg Coker on the air of Stand to Reason Ministries, STR.org. And keep in mind that STR and Deeper Waters here, we're both supported by listeners like you, so be willing to do your part to help ministries like ours out. Right now, we got some people that want to take some questions. You ready for them, Greg?
Sure am.
Okay, next one, first one is area code 913, and you are on the air. What is your question for Greg Coker?
Hello, am I on?
Yes.
Okay, hi, Greg and Nick.
Hi.
Hi there.
Greg, this is Dan Gwynn with FrancisSchaeferStudies.org.
Oh,
and yeah, I think Jason met you at a coffee place in Oklahoma.
Yes, that was a wonderful place. I can't remember the name of it, but I had a great time with all the people there. It was a great enterprise, and I have such a debt to the late Dr. Francis Schaeffer. He has deeply informed my approach to these kinds of things. It was formative for me to read his trilogy back in the 70s. So we have a kiss.
Jason just mentioned it, too. Oh, thank you. Well, Jason just mentioned Credo House. So
yes, that's it. Credo House.
Yeah. Right, right.
Well, my question for you, Greg, was, you know, some might be critical of beginning, you know, without the Bible in our discussions with people. And my question is, how much are we appealing to really a different form of revelation? And that this person is is truly created in the image of God, and that they are suppressing truth. And if maybe you could comment on that.
Yeah, this is a good question. my first thought when you asked that question was, did Jesus, for example, always start with the Bible? Well, as I'm thinking back on the discourses of Jesus, I don't know that he hardly ever started with the Bible. He used a lot of parables, but those were his parables. He made reference to biblical truths, no question, and he did cite the Bible to criticize his critics. You know, truly it has been written of you. You know, they were blind guides and that kind of stuff. But even Jesus himself wasn't thumping the Bible all the time. And I think the reason why is, even though his audience was probably much better informed about the Bible of his day, which is the Old Testament, than people are of the Bible of our day, even so, Jesus started with them. Notice all the agrarian illustrations that Jesus used, the farming mm-hmm. metaphors. Come unto me, all who are weary and heavy laden, for my yoke is light. You know, what's a yoke? Well, that's a thing that cows pull, oxen pull to pull a cart or a plow. You know, consider the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor spin, but they're clothed better than Solomon. Well, that's not a Bible verse. Well, it is now, but it wasn't then. And so I see Jesus especially drawing from common knowledge and awareness of things. By the way, that even that illustration from the Sermon on the Mount about the sparrows in the sky and the lilies of the field, Jesus is making an observation about natural revelation, the world that everyone has access to. He sees God's hand in it, and he draws a lesson about God's providence from it. So there's nothing wrong with going that route, as far as I could tell. Mm-hmm. Not only that, notice that the Columbo tactic, we're asking questions, since we're not starting preaching, we're asking questions to find out more about the other person and how they think and where they're at and that kind of thing. Jesus used questions all the time. Now, he usually used questions to pin somebody down. And this is it's kind of the third use of Columbo. I didn't get to talk about it much. But he used his questions to make a point. So we see Jesus using questions all the time. And so I'm not the least bit reluctant to use the method, the Columbo method, even if when I'm doing it I'm not quoting chapter and verse. What am I trying to do with the questions? I'm trying to use the questions to get to a point where I can communicate biblical truth, even if I'm not quoting scripture necessarily. I'm still communicating the truth of the Bible. And once again, I'm falling back on Jesus here. When Jesus made his points, lots of times he was clarifying what were Old Testament principles, but he wasn't necessarily just quoting them and throwing them out there. He was drawing on them and putting them in other words to make them more persuasive to the listeners in that circumstance. And I don't know why we can't do the same, Dan.
Right. If I can, let me ask maybe a follow-up question. Is that all right, Nick?
Yes, make it quick, because we got another caller waiting.
Okay, well, I will. So my next question, I'll just ask it, and then I'll hang up. Greg, I was curious, you know, how much is this sort of methodology just significant in today's circumstances with people? Because it seems that people are often more privatized. They don't go into these areas or don't want to talk about such things immediately. And I'm wondering, you know, your take on, you know, some of the obstacles we're dealing with just people as people in our culture today.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Dan, I've virtually never run into that problem, nor has the people that I have taught, and there have been thousands, but the people who got back to me on this, they said this has made things so much easier for them. I don't find that people are particularly circumspect. I mean, I'm careful about the questions I ask, and I'm not probing deep into the private recesses of their minds kind of thing. I'm just starting out kind of general. Most people, look, at the problem nowadays isn't that people are not talkative about their spiritual convictions. Christians may be reticent there, unfortunately, but outside of Christianity, people are blabbing about their convictions all the time. Mm-hmm. And putting down Christians for their narrow views while they're, you know, spouting their own narrow views as if they're the tolerant, open-minded folk when they're not. And so this gives us plenty of opportunity to engage people. It is characteristically only the Christian who says, well, my religion is very private. Gee, you know, other people are ready to talk about. Why is the Christian so reluctant to open his mouth, especially when he's got the most important things to talk about? Well, maybe they don't have a game plan, and that's why the tactics book was written.
Thank you, Dan.
And our next caller calling in here is from 704. So, caller, you are on the air with Greg Coker.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, Greg. My name is David. First, I'd like to thank you for the insights that you gave in tactics. It's helped me to identify and disarm an awful lot of rhetorical traps in conversations and gotcha questions and things like that.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad to hear that. And that's especially the other tactics that are in the book, the ones I mentioned earlier, but I'm glad to hear that. By the way, have you been using the Columbo questions?
I have. I've found myself using them. It's kind of easy to learn to use.
Uh-huh. That's true.
I do have a question, though.
Okay. Have you found people reluctant to engage you when you ask questions?
Absolutely not.
Yeah. See, that's the last
caller's
question, and I found the same thing. People love it. Exactly. Okay, Dave, what's your question?
My question is it relates to an application of the tactics that you lay out in the book.
Mm-hmm.
One of the more difficult situations that I found myself in once or twice is that I've got homosexual friends and acquaintances, and they announce that they've either gotten married or engaged or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And how can I, as a Christian, respond with grace and tact and avoid the rock and a hard place dilemma of,
sure,
on one side, unqualified approval, and the other side being unqualified and highly offensive disapproval?
Sure. Well, I draw some insight or maybe some guidelines from Paul here in 1 Corinthians, I think it's 5, and there you have a bad situation where somebody in the church is living a nasty life. And so he instructs the Corinthians. He said, I told you not to associate with immoral people. And then he said, I didn't say don't associate with immoral people in the world, because then you'd have to go out of the world and you're being sent into the world. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. I told you not to associate with immoral people in the church who profess to be Christians and then turn out to be living this ungodly lifestyle. And he tells them how to deal with that. Here's the principle that I derive from that, and that is we do not require non-Christians to live like Christians. And we ought not be shocked when they don't. We should be shocked when Christians don't live like Christians, and in fact, in the local church, we should demand that they take Christian things seriously. And notice how sometimes it's the other way around. We get all high-minded about non-Christians sinning, but then we got the same kind of sin in our own ranks, and we turn and look the other way. Well, Paul says it should be just the opposite. We should be careful about sin in our ranks, but we should be, we should not be judgmental of those in a certain sense. Outside, that is, we don't condescend to them because we're better than them or something like that. So my approach there, I would just let it roll off. You don't have to say, hey, hallelujah, praise the Lord, good for you, congratulations, see, I'm glad you finally found the right man or something like that. I think you can say, well, that's interesting, or all right, you know, or you just nod your head and smile. I understand that you don't want to be too positive about it because this isn't right, but at the same time, if you furrow up your brow and look down your nose at them, then obviously this isn't going to be a good thing anyway. And something that a lot of folks don't realize is homosexuality isn't the unforgivable sin. If these people weren't homosexual, they would have some other crime against God that they still had to deal with. So when I think about sharing Christ with people, I'm not focusing in on any particular sin. If they bring it up and that's an issue, well, then I have to be straight with them what the Scripture says. But I don't want to come across as condescending and nasty and all that if I can avoid it. The problem is, whoever they are, whatever their sin is, they are in rebellion against God, and that's not a good picture, because one day they're going to have to give an account, and they are not going to win this battle. And there's only one rescue for a God who hates rebels, and that is Jesus of Nazareth, the God-man, who died so that we could be forgiven of our own crimes against God. So, you know, I'm going to talk like that about their need for Christ. I am not going to deal with the homosexuality issue per se if I can avoid it. Sometimes you can't avoid it because they make that the issue. And I do think that there is a cultural policy issue that is important that we're dealing with in our culture about same-sex marriage and the like. And I do believe that Christians ought to weigh in on that in a thoughtful fashion, and there is information at str.org regarding same-sex marriage as a policy issue. But you're talking about an individual issue where people are touching base, and you know, going into big arguments against same-sex marriage is not going to make your message to them about Christ and His forgiveness more palatable to those people. I think we can just be friendly and just smile and nod or whatever. We don't have to say good for you or whatever. We just say okay, you know, and then just leave it at that. Now they may not like that. That is. Sometimes what is required by them is that we do backflips and celebrate diversity. We can't do that. And if somebody pressed me on that, I said, look, I believe in tolerance in this issue. What you guys are doing and considering, I don't think is right, but I'm not going to put that on you right now. I'm going to be friendly and tolerant to you. But that doesn't mean that I have to approve of that. And I can't in good conscience. In fact, if I did that, I'd be a hypocrite. Do you want me to be a hypocrite? So there's your Columbo question, you know.
Noted. Well, thank you very much. That's been probably the trickiest tactics issue that I have come across, and I think it's one that's going to I think we're going to see a whole lot more of in the very near
future. I think you're right, so. David. Listen, and what we're being called now is not intolerant, but we're being called bigots for our view. And when we get called bigot, you do the same thing as when you're called intolerant. You say, what do you mean by that?
What do you mean by that?
That's right. Yeah. Why would I be considered a bigot? So if I have, because I don't think most people even know what the word bigot means, which is an unreasonable hatred towards a particular group. I don't have a hatred towards them. I have a moral problem with it, and it's not unreasonable. Now, it may not be one that everybody agrees with, but it's not unreasonable. So I don't qualify for bigot, but a lot of times the person who's calling you bigot is the one who's got the unreasonable hatred towards Christians. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones who are guilty, not us, but they're the ones who are calling the name. So that's where the Columbo tactic can come in handy as well.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome, David. I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Thank you, David. And you might not know us, Greg. David happens to be a very good friend of mine. He was was my roommate for a while and best met at my wedding, so you've probably met him before sometime.
I probably have. Yeah. Well, and so that's your ringer caller, huh?
And, you know, I'm finding it interesting when you say us, Vada, the people we're worried about offending so much in this case are the ones that claim tolerance as their main virtue.
Yes, yes. That is such a good observation, though, that all the folks that are the tolerant crowd are the ones that turn out to be the nastiest.
Mm-hmm.
Even when Christians are really pleasant, but holding their ground about the truth of Christianity, then the other side comes out viciously and oftentimes, not every time, but oftentimes, viciously. And so it just goes to show that tolerance is a one-way street with a lot of people.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a long time. And when you talk about diversity and such, I mean, well, yeah, you know, you'd think the homosexual crowd and their supporters would want to celebrate the diversity of people who disagree with them.
You would think so, yeah.
Yeah, you would.
Yeah, where is in your diverse group, where's the Hasidic Jew, or where's the fundamentalist Christian, or where's the Mormon? No, you got all this sexual diversity, but everybody thinks exactly the same way about these issues. That's not diversity that matters.
You know, I really like how in your book also you talk about the woman who worked for someone who was a lesbian, and they were, and this person was a Christian, not the boss, but the lesbian. But yeah, everyone knows what I'm saying. But
yes.
The boss wasn't a Christian, but the person was, and the boss comes up to him and says, "What do you think about my being a lesbian?"
Right.
And you instruct her that she should give the response of, "Before I answer this question, will you judge me as intolerant for whatever I say?"
Right, right. Would you consider yourself a tolerant person? Is the question, and or in other words, do you think your view is the only right way, and anybody who differs from your view is wrong? That's the question to ask the lesbian. And now, what is she going to do? She can either say she's intolerant, and if she says I'm not tolerant, I think my way is right. And notice that I'm using the postmodern definition of tolerance.
Yep.
Against her. I think that's a distorted definition, but in any event, that's the definition they're using. If she says that, then the gals could say, "Well, if you're going to be intolerant to me, I'm not even tell you what I believe. That's not a safe environment." But if she says, "Okay, she's tolerant," now it's going to be very difficult. If the Christian gives her view about lesbianism, it's going to be hard for the lesbian then to attack her if she's already admitted that she's tolerant. So yeah, that I find sometimes you use that question to kind of set the stage and protect yourself in advance.
Well, Greg, I think you had said you'd only be able to give us an hour, and you know, you're welcome back on the show anytime you want to. If you want to stay another hour, I'd be fine with that.
I've got things I got to get to here, Nick. I've got a writing deadline for next week, and I just a bunch of stuff on my table. Even though it's Saturday, I'm still working, just like you are.
Yeah. But I do thank you for coming on, and mind everyone that your material can be found at str.org, and to listen to your radio show from 2 to 5 Pacific time on your Standard Reason, or they can listen to it on podcast. And you got the book Tactics, and you talk about relativism. You've also got a book you wrote with Francis Beckwith, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair.
That's right.
That's another great one. And I encourage people to listen, and I'm sure you encourage people as well to listen to the final hour of our podcast.
Well, Nick, thanks so much for spending some time together.
Thank you. And we'll be back after this with just me this time on the Deeper Waters podcast. We'll be back after this message. Special thanks to Greg Coker for taking time out of his schedule to join us.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You could send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And we are back with the Deeper Waters podcast. I am Nick Peters, your host. Greg Coker has been with us for an hour. It was a great hour. I'd like to thank the people who called in. And I'd like to say, you can still call in. I'm here to answer questions on whatever issues you've got on your mind right now. That's 714-242-5180. And so we're just going to be talking about some general stuff until the hour ends here. And I'd like to tell you all also that next week we are going to have Rob Bowman be on here to talk about issues that whatever's on his mind to discuss. It should be a very interesting show. And next month we are going to have several shows lined up, and several of them will be dealing with Autism Awareness Month. In fact, the very first show in April we are going to have on Jacob Alexander. He wrote a book called In the Barely of Aware. It's about his son who was born with Asperger's as well, and I've read it. It's a very interesting story, very motivational story, and as listeners know, my wife and I have the same condition, and I am just really looking forward to that. We've also got scheduled to come on there. We got someone talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses. I'm hoping I can get Scott Klusendorf, but we are going to have David Enstone Brewer come on the 20th. He's going to be talking about his book, The Jesus Scanders, and he'll be telling us a little bit about Asperger's at Cambridge and about how Jesus would have handled people who were disabled in his time. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit until someone calls in, of course, about something I wrote yesterday. I had written about our youth are not prepared. See, in our culture, the church has not done its diligence for youth. We've made Christianity be a religion all about application and how you live your life instead of realizing Christianity is all about Christ. And frankly, our young people don't really know much about Christ. Most of them do not have any clue how they could answer a Jehovah's Witness. In fact, the sad reality is most of them probably don't even know a Jehovah's Witness needs to be answered. Is this because our youth are dumb? No, it's not. I find many times they are highly intelligent. They just need some information. Problem is, we're not giving that information out to them. If there's any youth pastors out here listening to this, I urge you to pay attention, especially pastors as well, and parents of youth. Because, look, the world is not a safe place anymore. It doesn't matter if your kids go off to Bible college or seminary. It is still not a safe place for them. Because they will be inevitably asking questions. In the age of the internet, there are people out there who are wanting to evangelize your children, and they are not going to evangelize them with Christianity. I'd like you to picture a situation. You've got a boy who's, say, 13 or so, and he wants to go on YouTube and listen to a song by his favorite Christian band. So he's there, he's listening, he's enjoying himself, kind of like what I'm doing when I listen to the Deeper Waters intro here. And he looks on the side, and there is a video by a YouTube atheist on why there is no God. Never heard anything like that before. So he clicks it. And he listens. And, well, he's stunned. He's never heard anything like this. And then there's some about, here's how the Bible isn't reliable. And he can go on and on. It doesn't take too long to make an atheist this way. And sadly, this is happening regularly. And this could be before the kid even goes off to college. When he goes off to high school, he's going to face temptations left and right. What he's going to be in the locker room before gym class one day, and he's going to be asked why he's never slept with a girl. And if all he gives is a few verses from Paul, he's going to be laughed at as a prude, and that social stigma is going to hurt him. Or some people might say that he's gay, you know, these tolerant people who want us to understand homosexuals and still use homosexuality as an insult somehow. Any number of things will happen, and frankly, even if this doesn't happen, I can guarantee you, when he's out on a date with his lady, he is going to be tempted. Yeah, when Allie and I were dating, we were tempted. And I'm a ministry student. I'm someone who takes this seriously, incredibly. She took it seriously, too. And we were still tempted. And you know what? There's nothing wrong with being tempted that way. Temptation happens. What is wrong, though, is when you give in to temptation. It is not a sin to be tempted. It is a sin to give in. Frankly, guys, if you weren't tempted, I would have a whole lot of questions to ask you. But our youth need to be ready. Now, when they go off to college, I picture three things can happen when their faith is challenged. And the first two are disaster situations. First one more so. That's outright apostasy. Most atheists I meet tend to be ex-Christians today. And unfortunately, their mindset of thinking hasn't changed. They approach the Bible with the same kind of mindset. They just have a different allegiance to it. In fact, we have one of our callers mention Credo House. And they have a ministry with the Parchment and Pen blog, where C. Michael Patton there has recently written an excellent blog on 8 issues that don't make or break Christianity. And I'm finding it amazing how many people are willing to comment and say, yes, they do. Yes, they do. If we don't have inspiration when Jesus didn't rise from the dead. If we don't have inerrancy, Jesus didn't rise from the dead. If we have evolution, Jesus didn't rise from the dead. That's essentially what's being said. Now, don't get me wrong. Your views on that one can be important. For instance, I do hold to inerrancy, and I do hold to inspiration. If you ask me about evolution, I say, you know what? I'm not a scientist. I'm not answering. I leave that question to the scientist. I deal with New Testament stuff, and when I look at the history of the world and the New Testament documents, I see that they're reliable, and I see that there's a strong case to be made that Jesus rose from the dead. But when you attach other beliefs to Christianity and make them just as essential, then you start having problems. For instance, if someone's presented with one Bible contradiction that they can't deal with, they automatically go into a panic and they conclude Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Now, I don't think the Bible contradicts itself, but you know what? There are thousands of reported contradictions that take place. I doubt any one of us can memorize all the answers to every single one of them constantly. That is a huge burden to take on. That's not saying that they can't be answered. I'm saying we can't all memorize them. And this really puts a burden on us, because when a skeptic comes to us, all they have to do to dismiss any way they can listen to the gospel at all is to just say, well, there's a contradiction here, and I don't accept any of it then. This is a bad way to do history as well. If we were studying Plutarch or Thucydides or Tacitus or any other historian, we would not say they have one mistake, they have one contradiction or something of that sort, therefore everything is false. If we did that, we really wouldn't know anything about ancient history. For that matter, we wouldn't really know much about modern history as well. We do as we study the cases, look for evidence for or against, and come to a conclusion. Personally, I'm not out here to get you to believe something about the Bible. I hope I can, but that's not my main goal. My first goal is to get you to believe something about Jesus. That is, namely, he is the one who came from God, the second person of the Trinity, died again, rose on the third day for our sins in his physical body. If I can get you there, I think I've done my work. And if you've got some errant beliefs along the way, I think God can help you sort those out, and I'll be glad to do my part. And let's face it, we all have some wrong beliefs. I'm quite confident I teach some things that are wrong. And in fact, that's something that Greg Coker has even said, and I give the same response he'd give when someone asks, why are you still teaching them? And I'd answer, I don't know what they are. If I knew they were wrong, I wouldn't teach them. But, you know, the Bible is a big book. There's a whole lot of issues involved with it. I seriously doubt I am the only person in history, aside from Jesus, who's got everything right about it. But to get back to what was being said, these people will apostatize, and they will be even harder to win back to the fold if you think such a thing is possible. And I'm always open to that being possible, because they can always think, they've been there, they've done that, they've bought the t-shirt, it didn't work. And chances are they think you're just as ignorant of the facts as they were at one point. And when we do not evangelize our own youth, do not train them properly, we are setting them up to be these kinds of fundy atheists. Well, that's the first thing that can happen. The second thing that can happen, it's bad, it's not as bad, but still damaging, is they will go into what I call an isolation shutdown mode. In this case, they will say, I am going to keep my faith regardless. You know, to be sure, they have a totally wrong notion of what faith is, but they are going to hold on to it. And in order to do this, they can't allow themselves to encounter facts or true information about the world. Now, I think in reality, of course, they can, and when they find that true information and study it, they will be Christians. But these people are convinced that factually the world is against them, but they still have to know that Jesus rose from the dead, so they will just cut themselves off from the culture. And they often join other people who have done the same thing in isolation chambers, usually called churches. Yes, I know not all churches are like that, but too many of them are, with Christians just gathering together and trying to give each other assurances, trying to get themselves to just feel Christianity is true. Now, there's nothing wrong ipso facto with having a feeling that Christianity is true. That feeling, like any other feeling, doesn't need to be hanging in midair. It needs a foundation. You know, there are some times that we can go through life and we'll just start suddenly feeling depressed or anxious for no reason that we can really think of. And I think, why do I feel that way? And you know what? If you can't really think of a good reason why you feel a certain way, you say, well, you know what? I don't need to give that feeling much credibility. It doesn't mean the feeling will go away, but it means you don't give it much credibility. And personally, we all need to learn how to control our feelings. And my wife can tell you there are times that anxiety does get the better of me, and I have a hard time falling asleep at night most times. Thankfully, I've been getting a lot better at that. Mainly what I've tried to do at night is think about a passage from the New Testament and just ask myself questions about it over and over. It's very amusing, and whenever I get up, usually my mind just jumps right back to that and says, okay, let's start asking those questions once more. And this can also be done with some light reading before going to bed. Some of it's very helpful. And this is part of learning to be a Christian. It's learning to think soundly. It's not just having facts. It's having good reasoning. But these people, when they shut themselves off in isolation chambers, now, they're still Christians, but they're not having any impact on the world whatsoever. In fact, I could say that's not entirely accurate. They are having a negative impact because they are giving people the impression that this is what Christianity is. And so when someone like myself or Greg Coker goes out, we have to deal with this presupposition on the part of the unbelieving world that Christians are ignorant people who believe things without any evidence whatsoever. So, in essence, these people make the jobs of ones like myself all the more difficult. Fortunately, they're still Christians, but they're not doing anything. Now, there's a small minority who will have their faith challenged in a place like college, and they will take the proper path, and that is study. These people will go to the library. They will go to the bookstores. They will talk to experts as much as they can. They will seek to find the answers. And personally, I'd rather talk to someone who did this and was still remaining an atheist than someone who didn't and was remaining a Christian. At least for the second person, I think I can have a reasoned discussion with. But these people, if they do this and they come out as Christians, which I think they would, I believe they will be some of the strongest defenders of the faith that we have. And we need them. But the sad thing is, if they are willing to do that then, they were probably always willing to do that. They just didn't know about it. Now, my faith wasn't challenged when I went to college, but college was where I found out about apologetics to begin with. And my faith had been challenged on the internet. And when I started reading these books, all of a sudden I had a new passion in life. My mother would get very concerned when she'd see me coming home from a bookstore, and I'd have five or six books in my hands, and she'd say, how much did you spend today? And all of a sudden, I had to be asking for bookshelves for Christmas. And I was reading anything I could get my hands on. And now, I really look back on this, and I think, why didn't anyone in the church tell me about this all my life? How much better I could have been spending my time before then. And if you want to know something that drives me on this show, it's that. And it's one reason I'm so passionate about helping the youth out. Because I don't want any of them to wind up in the same boat that I was in. If they've got young minds and they're willing to work with them, I want to get them started early. How early as I can. Because I tell you, the other side is not waiting. You watch your TV shows, listen to your music, they are sending a message out through that. Could be a good message, could be a bad message from a world that's most likely a bad one. But we need to be getting our message out there. I talked about the dating scene, for instance. I can tell you, Christians, there is a Christian view of sex, there is a non-Christian view of sex. If we're not getting ours out there, I can guarantee you that our youth are getting the other side. They're getting it loud and clear. And we'd better have a comparable message on our side. And frankly, we don't. Okay, that's been our first segment here in this last hour. If you disagree with some things I've said or really want to talk to me about them, give me a call. My number is 714-242-5180. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast, and we will be back after this break.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gifts if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You could send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
Check out cyiworldwide.com. cyiworldwide.com, home of Grock Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. cyiworldwide.com. Do you grok?
And we're back. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. I'd like to remind you all, since we played something about donating, Deeper Waters is listener-supported, including the blog that we do. Now, that blog can be found at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. I update it. I try my best to update it 5 nights a week. And there is a newsletter you can subscribe to. You can do that by going to our Facebook page. Just look for Deeper Waters on Facebook. If it's possible, my wife can even provide a link in the chat. She handles the chat, so I'm not really seeing anything goes on there with my personality. I'd be too distracted. But we need your donations and we need your support. Anytime we get something from you, it just thrills our hearts so much. And we want you to know that you support the work of apologetics in the church today. And you want to stand behind it. You don't want your youth to go the way of apostasy or shutdown. Now, I'm reading a book right now. It's by Jonathan T. Pennington, a foreword by Richard Bauckham, called Reading the Gospels Wisely. Now, I've just finished part one. Well, actually, no, I think I'm about to finish it, and then we're going to get into the other material in it, but already I'm thinking this is an incredibly helpful book. But frankly, in our day and age, we don't pay as much attention to the Gospels as we should. Most of us tend to jump straight to Paul. And I'm not against Paul. Paul's great. We need Paul. Thank God for Paul. But we also need the Gospels. The Gospels tell us the story of Jesus. And without that story, Paul doesn't make sense. You need the Gospels, the story of the Gospels, I mean, to know Paul. Paul wrote before the Gospels were written, but the information that is in the Gospels is before Paul. When we read the Gospels, we also do tend to read them through the lens of Paul. And we don't need to do that. We need to read the Gospels in their own right. We need to read them as documents about the life of Christ and realize he might not exactly be talking about justification by faith every single time. He might have other things in mind in what he's saying. We need to learn to read each gospel in its own light. Now, right now, I'm spending a lot of time on the Gospel of Matthew. I've come to really treasure it. In fact, it happened more when I was giving myself scripture to deal with the ways I was thinking. And one of those was when I got to Matthew 6, and it was, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you." Now, I've asked people about this passage before, and I've said, look, if we're Christians, here's what we ask ourselves. First off, did Jesus say it? Most of us who hold to an inerrancy will say, yeah. Yeah, he said it. Next question we're going to ask, did he believe it? Well, Jesus, Son of God, would seem to imply he's honest. Yeah, he believed it. Well, he said it, he believed it, is it true? And combined with the other two, we're kind of obligated to say yes. Yes, it's true. So when you ask, well, are we doing it? That's the final question I think we have to ask. What does this passage mean? Are we doing it? And so when we seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, we have to start thinking, okay, what's the kingdom? What is his righteousness? Are we really seeking to live righteous lives or not? Is holiness really something that grips us? I tell you, it needs to be something that grips us. I have someone I highly respect, and I email this person every night. They're helping me to make sure I pray regularly, and I email them every night and say, here's my prayer, here's some what's going on in my life, here's how you can be praying for me. And they often write back, give me some good, sound advice. Friends, we all need someone like that. And I've told several of my friends that, listen, I want you to start holding me accountable. I want you to start asking me, am I praying the way I should be? Now, I'm going to say, I would tell you that she thinks I'm a great husband, and I try my best to be. But I also want my friends to be able to look me straight in the face and say to me, are you being a good husband? Are you loving your wife the way Christ loved the church? And I want them to be able to ask me, are you being faithful? Are you focusing on her? These questions need to be asked. Are they embarrassing at times? Yes. And my own wife is listening and thinking, of course he's being faithful to me. And I am. But I need to be asked it anyway, because I don't need to be told, you are too good to not screw up. Frankly, we can all screw up in every single area whatsoever. And as soon as we think we are above a sin, we are putting ourselves in great danger. And of course, as I say this, I also don't mean to give my wife any alarm. As I've said numerous times, I adore her. But I also do know I'm a fallible man, and she doesn't need someone who's got pride. So I am going to do my part to make sure I am living holy. And if that means I have to face some embarrassment from my friends every now and then, I will gladly take it. I would rather be embarrassed before them than embarrassed before her and my God later on if I screwed up. And so when I started looking at this, when I started thinking about this term, and then I started thinking about it in the grand scheme of things, I look and say, okay, what's going on in the Sermon on the Mount? What's being talked about here? How does this relate? Is all Jesus doing just giving us good ethics? Or is it something more? And then I'd go back to the very beginning of the gospel, and I'd start asking questions. What is the purpose of this genealogy? Why does he start talking about Abraham and David both? Why those two out of everyone else? Why is there so much use of scripture in certain places talking about a prophecy being fulfilled? And one aspect I kept coming on, which if you've read N.T. Wright a lot like I have, you wouldn't be surprised here, is the kingdom. N.T. Wright has said that when we read the creed, we hear, born under the Virgin Mary, crucified under Pontius Pilate. And we think, you know, there's something being skipped in all of that. That maybe those chapters leading up to the Passion and after the birth of Jesus, we really do have some important things for us. and we need to be willing and receptive to get those things. One aspect I wrote on of this, with the kingdom, in fact, is the Great Commission. When we look at the Great Commission in Matthew 28, 18 through 20, Jesus' words to his disciples in Matthew, the last words he says, "Go ye therefore into all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, making disciples, doing all that I have commanded you." We look at that usually and say, oh, that's a call to evangelism. In a sense, it is. But it's not just that. Notice how it starts. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. In other words, Jesus is saying, right now, at this point, I have all authority in heaven and earth. Jesus is king right then. And then we follow the old hermeneutic rule. Whenever you see a therefore, take a look and see what it's there for. And what it is saying, since Jesus has this, this is what follows. And now you are going to give out into all the world, doing what I have commanded. What's that word? Commanded. He's not saying what I've requested. He's not saying what I've suggested. He's saying what I've commanded. Making disciples of all nations. In other words, what's going on here? Jesus is giving marching orders. He is telling his disciples in the last minute, I am the king. This is what you are to do for me. You are to go to the world and give a message. Now really, stop and think about this. They were to go out into the Roman Empire, where Caesar was king, and give the message that Jesus is king instead. Do you think this message could be a little bit controversial? It would be as if to go out into our country and say, there's someone else who's the real president. Or even better, it'd be like going into a Muslim country and saying, Jesus is a real ruler of this country, not the person in charge. Or even going into a communist country and saying the same thing. In the last two cases, it can be a walking death sentence. And tradition has it, aside from one of them, all of the disciples were executed for their faith. Now, some of those traditions might be shaky in some areas and such. I'll leave that to other church historians, but I think it's significant. Perhaps church history does say all of them became martyrs for their faith, and some of them apparently in very gruesome ways. They died because they were giving a message the world didn't want to hear, and frankly, the world still doesn't want to hear this message. We are in the exact same boat. The difference with us, I think, is we've toned down the message a whole lot. We've made it be a message primarily about forgiveness. Forgiveness is good. It's an important message. It's a message we should be sharing. But there is another message to give out. Forgiveness entails this message. It is the message that Jesus is king. If you want to be on right terms with him, you had better get in line with him, which means forgiveness, because you owe him a debt due to your wrong actions. Now, along these lines of the Great Commission, one of the questions that we're often asked is, what about those who never heard the gospel? Some of you are going to be disappointed because I'm not going to really answer this question outright. My response is always, the judge of all the earth will do what's right. No one on the last day will be able to say it wasn't fair. What I will tell you is, in many ways, this question doesn't even matter. It's not going to change the fact that Jesus rose from the dead. And if he didn't rise from the dead, it's also not going to change that. That is what must be dealt with. You can't say, I don't know what will happen to those who've never heard, therefore Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Huh? There's no connection between the two of them. Now, that doesn't mean it's not an important question, but it's a non-essential question. We need to realize that. This question is not a defeater for Christianity. But the reason I bring it up is because when Jesus gives us our marching orders, he tells us to go. There is no plan B. There is nothing that he says that, if you do not do this, this is what I would do instead. He gives us that burden. And we are the slaves of Christ. We are to do it. Why? Because our master said to. And we need to return with the kingdom of God to the notion that Jesus is our master. We are his slaves. And whatever we do it dutifully. Last month we had a fundraiser here for Deeper Waters. We have a friend who sells jewelry. And she offered to have us a fundraiser there, and 25% of the proceeds would go to Deeper Waters. Okay. Well, we weren't able to advertise, I think, as much as we should. And in the end, we raised about $75. Now, I could have been upset and said we only had two sales over in all, and we got this much in, and we need so much more, and this is what we got, yada, yada, yada. But I had decided in advance I would accept whatever happened. You know what? We got enough. I was able to go out and get a good headset so I could do this podcast. We had some left over. I was able to put that aside for us. And I gave thanks for it. Because Jesus didn't owe me a single penny. That he gave me anything whatsoever is a gift of his grace. That I get to serve is a gift of his grace. We so forget all the things that he has given us, that we have eternal life with him. We have forgiveness of our sins. And look at the world around you. It doesn't have to have color. It doesn't really have to have sound. It doesn't have to have taste. It doesn't even have to have pleasure. The world could have existed without these things. But they are all there. They are gifts from our Creator. I told Ali, I think it was last night, that I was just thinking when we were watching TV that night, we were watching Tanked together. I was getting in some reading. And I said, at one point, after this episode, we need to go to bed. And she agreed. And when I said that, my mind started thinking of, yeah, I get to go to bed with my wife every night. I am a blessed person, which, by the way, a lot of you females out there listening need to realize this. Nerds like myself are very devoted husbands. If you want a devoted husband, marry a nerd. But I gave thanks for it. So, you know, I get to enjoy the company of a woman, and I get to enjoy building a relationship with her in a way I never thought I'd be able to. And that is a great gift. And all the reason I think I can get depressed and anxious sometimes is because I've taken my eyes out off of all the good gifts he has given me. So when I've been reading the Gospels wisely, I've been trying to look at what Jesus says about the kingdom and see things in a whole new light. You know what? When I do that, it's not about me anymore. I'm not out here trying to build up my kingdom. I'm building up his kingdom. Yes, it can be tempting to make it about you. That's the temptation for all of us. But everything we do, we are to do for Christ. Every single action whatsoever is to be done Christ. We are to realize he is the master of all. The greatest commandment he gave us was, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. With everything we have, we ought to love God. I don't know about you, but I'm falling short. I know I am several times. I would quite guess you are, because we're all fallen, sinful creatures, and part of having a good mentor is realizing how fallen you are and how much work needs to be done to get you to where you need to be. But being able to face those issues and say, I want to be able to do the best that I can for the kingdom, therefore I'm going to make such and such a change, and if it's embarrassing where it's embarrassing, but I'd rather be embarrassed before the world than be embarrassed before God one day. Well, I've given you a little bit to think about, I hope. Right now, we are going to go to our final break. We'll come back. We'll have our final segment. If you'd like to discuss some of this stuff, please give me a call. I'd love to take your call. The number is 714-242-5180. We will be back in a little bit with the Deeper Waters podcast.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. That's www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at CYIWorldwide.com.
And we are back on the air for the final segment of the Deeper Waters podcast. I am Nick Peters. The number is 714-242-5180. Yeah, I've been talking about the kingdom of God here and reading the Gospels wisely, and I will say I do hope I can get in touch with the author and see if he's going to be willing to be on the show sometime. If he's listening by some chance, feel free to contact me. And I am constantly trying to get the best guest that I can on the program for your pleasure, and so you can be affirmed and encouraged to walk in your faith. Now, when we look at the Gospels, part of the reason I think we tend to go straight to Paul usually is we are people who tend to want just the answers, just the doctrines. The danger is we miss out on the stories. In that case, we miss out on these being lived in real life. And you have to remember, the Old Testament is full of stories. In fact, it starts with stories. Genesis and Exodus are very largely stories. Yes, there's other things thrown in there, but by and large, you are reading a story. And strangely enough, even when we read those stories, we get some doctrines out of them. These stories, we are shaped the way we look at our world, our God, and Jesus. And when we look at Jesus and see him living his life, we realize this is a person who we are to imitate. Now, we don't imitate him for salvation. There's always that danger. We also realize there are ways we can't imitate him. We can't claim to be divine, for instance. But as far as moral living goes, we should strive to be like Jesus regularly. And Christ-likeness is just something that's not talked about that often. And I recently had a friend come to me who was talking about his interest in a lady. And one of the things we started talking about after that was Christ-likeness. Gave him a story about I worked at a job once, and one of the girls on the job came up to me, which was a couple of years ago, and said, I need to learn about forgiveness. What's the best way to learn about forgiveness? And without missing a beat, I said, get married. you will spend most of your time, a good portion of it, either giving it or receiving it. And I personally, I think I've spent most of our time of forgiveness receiving it. Because when you live intimately with someone else, you start seeing a lot of things in your own character that you don't like, when you see those reactions that you don't think about, but you seem to do instinctively, and you ask, oh my gosh, where did that come from? And if I do that again, I'm going to hurt the other person so much, and I don't want to do that. And you start growing in Christ-likeness. It could involve you have to say a little prayer right then, something maybe along the lines of, Lord, I'm getting very frustrated right now. Please don't let me blow up at this point. And, you know, whenever you do something like that, you are learning dependence on God. That is one of the greatest lessons you can learn. As I've said before, my wife and I are going through an extremely tough time financially, which is one reason we value your support so much, so we can keep doing this. But in this time, I think we have learned a lot about what it means to depend on God and not take things for granted. And I think whenever we get in a position where we have regular income coming in, we are going to be very, very careful with it. Because we never want to be in this boat again. And if we ever get to a point someday where we have kids, which is something we won't complain about, we are going to be very careful with how we raise them financially as well, and know to set aside money for them right now. We are in many ways getting a crash course in finances right now because of our situation. Now, I'm not happy about it, but you know, I can say, you know what, I'm going to try and learn something from this. And this is part of a Romans 8 principle. If you remember Romans 8, it is one of the most glorious passages in the Bible. And it has that great line in it of, all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. And before I get on that, I'd like to remind you, we've only got 13 minutes left, but if you'd like to discuss some of this with me, my number is 714-242-5180. But all things work together for good to them that love the Lord. And I'd like you to know something about that passage. It doesn't say all things are good. Let's be frank. Some things are not good. There are many things we wish wouldn't happen. And that's fine. There are times we go through life that are extremely painful. That's fine. And my wife and I have been reading a book lately, and we were surprised to read about Mother Teresa, for instance. She went through 50 years or so, and what she talked about was the silence of God in her years. I was very surprised to hear about that. You'd think that Mother Teresa would have been someone who had a vibrant spiritual life, and it looks like she didn't. You know, when you're in that time, it's not good. I've been there. It's not good. I've had major surgery before. That wasn't good. Most of you don't know, I had scoliosis surgery. Having your back cut open and a steel rod strapped on your spine is not put high on a list of things I want to experience before I die. Shortly after we got married, Mary and I went to bed one night, and I got up to turn off a light and came back in. I'd been having some stomach aches all night, but by the time I got to the bedroom, I was screaming, and she had to call a friend of ours who was a doctor. My wife can't drive, so she depended on someone else there. This doctor took me to the hospital after a little while. Yeah, it was that bad. How bad was it? Well, here we are, still newlyweds, and I'm getting ready to have gallbladder surgery now. And by the way, my grandmother had just died, too. So, things were piling up on us. You know what, it was a hard time, but I went through it. And honestly, looking back, it was one of the most rewarding times in many cases in my life. Because what I've been told about it was that I remember waking up, and our pastor was at the foot of my bed, but right there beside me, most prominent in my view, there was my wife right there. And she's just smiling at me, and later on I had asked her, and I said, "How long has you been waiting there?" And she said, "Oh, I hadn't been waiting long. They had told me you were already awake and you were calling my name." I have no memory of that whatsoever. And I've been told also that as I was going out, they gave me the medication before the surgery and the IV. I remember saying, "Does anyone else hear singing or is it just me?" To which my pastor said, "Yeah, he's getting ready to go." And I've been told my wife's name was last thing I said before I went out too. So again, her name was last thing I said before I went out and the first thing I said when I came out. So right there for me, I have a great memory. We had to spend those couple weeks learning to do things differently. My diet consisted largely of pizza at the time. That's changed since then. That's something unusual about us Aspies. My wife was supportive and said, "If you can't eat it, I'm not going to eat it either during this time." And she didn't. I was doing teaching at the church. I'd have someone drive me there, and I'd had to have the seat up there to sit there. I said, "You know what? I'm assigned to teach. I'm going to teach." And I was teaching on the incarnation, and that's exactly what I did. So the surgery itself, no, it wasn't the time I wanted to go through the most. It was painful to recover. But, you know, it's worked for good. But the requirement that things work for good is that you love the Lord. And let's remember what love means. Love means you seek the good of the other person. You want what is good for the Lord. So I love my spouse. I want what's good for her. She loves me. She wants what's good for me. We love our parents. We want what's good for them. They love us. They want what's good for us. Do we want what's good for God? Or do we want what's good for ourselves the most? See, if we want what's good for God, things will, in the end, work for our good. Now, I do think it could be that that good might not always come about in this life. It will come about in what I call the after death. But these things will work for our good. These are the things we need to be learning. And when we're reading the Gospels, we need to look at Jesus and see what kind of person he was. I recently went back to my old Bible college and I was visiting some professors, and one of them said, "I was reading the triumphant entry and something leapt out at me that I never really noticed." And that was that people were asking the question, "Who is this man?" That's a question people ask about Jesus. Who is he? Hardly any other great teacher in history, I think, has had that question. People knew who Muhammad was. He was a prophet of Allah. People knew who Confucius was. He was a wise teacher. People knew who Moses was. Moses was the one who gave us the law. But who was Jesus? Was he the Messiah? Was he deity? Was he just a great prophet? Was he an avatar? Was he an enlightened one? Was he a liar? Was he a lunatic? Who was he? That question was even the subject of his trial. Who is he? And today we have to look at Jesus and ask the question, who is he? And we will find a lot of that in the Gospels as we see the doctrine being lived out. We can go to Paul several times and get verses that back his deity, but if we want to see him living as deity, we have to go to the Gospels. We have to. We turn to them and look and say, okay, what is the character of Jesus revealed in the Gospels? Why is he doing this? Why is he not doing this? What does he mean by this? What does that promise that he's made mean? How do I apply this to my life? You know, that could involve a lot of study. In fact, I'd say it necessarily would. And part of that study would be getting past our own American conceptions and trying to read the text as if we were ancient Jews. And we really want to try to read the Bible for the first time. We want to let ourselves be amazed by the text. We don't want to do something like, say, go to the Sermon on the Mount and say, yeah, I know the Sermon on the Mount. And we want to go and really listen to the Sermon on the Mount. We want to think, if we were here for the first time, what would we be hearing? See, I know when I'm in church on Sundays and my pastor is giving a sermon, I'm thinking of a whole lot of questions I would like to ask during the service. I can't really ask them, but I'm thinking of them. Am I going to say I'm not going to think of questions I'd want to ask if Jesus was speaking? I would hope so. If there is anyone whose words I'd want to understand in the New Testament, it's Jesus. I want to know what he said. I want to know what he meant. I want to know what he did. So I'm going to look at those words. I'm going to study them hard. It's going to involve studying the text as much as I can, using whatever tools I can, and talking to people who know matters better than I do. Sometimes I can't talk to them directly, but they have ways of talking to me and I can listen. They're called books. I don't have, say, Jonathan Pennington right here in front of me. You know what? I have his book. His book contains his thoughts, and when I read, he is communicating with me. We haven't had people call in here, but right now, you are listening to my thoughts and taking them in. I hope you're raising a lot of questions to them. I hope that you're willing to investigate them and see what you can see about them. And I would really love it if you believe what I said, but I don't want you to believe what I say blindly. I want you to study it. If you do disagree, you can get in touch with me and let me know. Again, my blog can be found at deeperwaters.wordpress.com. And the call-in number here is 714-242-5180. We've only got about 3 minutes left, so chances are we don't have time to take your call today. But I am going to be here next week. We're going to have Rob Bowman here with me as well. But friends, the main thing I want to tell you is be prepared. Now, Greg Coker's book, Greg Coker being who we had on here earlier, it's a good way for you to start, even if you're one, especially if you're one who's unprepared with the knowledge already. This way, you can at least go into the conversation without being terrified. You can just go up to people and start asking them questions. And as we heard from my friend David who called in, people seem to love it when you ask them questions. They don't seem to mind talking about themselves in that way. And when you do ask questions, you're on a fact-finding mission. In the end, also, you're going to be learning a few things. You might not agree with everything the other person says. You might agree with some of it. And by the way, be open to that. When you read the non-Christian, when you talk to the non-Christian, not everything they say is wrong. They will say some things that are right. Be open to that. Be ready to listen to it. Be ready to hear it. But get a book like Tactics and go through it and be ready to study it and apply it. Friends, this is a war we're in. We have orders from the king, and we are to do them. In closing, I'd like to remind everyone, Greg Coker's material can be found at str.org, Stand to Reason Ministries. His show is on from 2 to 5 Pacific Time every Sunday. And personally, I think his ministry is excellent. I highly endorse it. My own work here, deeperwaters.wordpress.com. Now, next week, we are going to have Rob Bowman with us. I encourage you all, please tune in again and be listening. Tell your friends and family about the Deeper Waters podcast. We'd love to see a lot of listeners. and be in remembrance that we need your financial support and your prayer support as well. Until then, I'm Nick Peters for Deeper Waters Podcast, signing off.